Hi, and welcome back. During this little mini-shiur, we're going to discuss a little bit about Greek philosophy. We'll start our discussion now and pick it up a little bit later. We're about to approach a point in the Kuzari text where the king summons his four disputants, the four clerics, the philosopher, the Christian, the Muslim, and the Jew. So what I'd like to start with is the first of our clerics, the philosopher. Before we do this, however, let's bring ourselves up to that point with reviewing some of the ideas that we've discussed in our previous talks. The main protagonist of the Kuzari is a pagan king named King Bulan of the Khazar people, who is a righteous man and wants to do the right thing. He's visited in a dream, wherein an angel tells him, "Your intentions are desirable to your creator, but not your deeds." And so, and previously we've discussed how this one statement is extremely relevant in couching Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's view of what the Torah is and what God expects of every Jew. And in paragraph 1, subparagraph 4, and I'll just read it for you, it says, "After the dream, this prompted the king to explore other belief systems and religions. Ultimately, the king, together with a great populace of the Khazars, converted to Judaism. Many of the rabbi's arguments have given me peace of mind," and this is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi speaking, "and are in accord with my own thinking. I have therefore decided to record the arguments in dialogue form as they were originally presented. Hopefully, perceptive readers will gain much understanding from them." Now, that last phrase, that perceptive readers will gain much understanding from them, is really a sort of taking license with the words in Hebrew, v'hamaskilim yavinu, which means the wise will be able to understand. And that's certainly one way of understanding what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is saying in those couple of words. But in reality, some commentaries say that what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is actually doing is giving an esoteric little wink at his audience. And he's telling us, those of you in the know recognize that what I'm about to present in the Kuzari is really historical fiction. This is really a fabrication of a dialogue that may or may not have occurred in the way that I'm presenting it. Let the maskilim, let the people in the know understand that I'm merely utilizing the Socratic method, this method of literature that helps engage the reader and draws him into the discussion. Now, once the king realizes that his work in the pagan shrines are not satisfying the angel, he seeks out the philosopher. And it's very telling that the philosopher is the very first cleric that is brought into the kingdom. The fact that he's the first indicates that, at least for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, he is the most formidable of the four, the one that the king will assume is the most correct. Now, why is that? It's because his belief system, the belief system of the philosopher, presents itself as the most developed and sophisticated way of life and doctrine. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi will have something to say about this later. But in order to understand the words of the philosopher, I think we should first understand a few fundamentals of philosophy, particularly the brand of philosophy that was popular during Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's lifetime. Now, Jewish philosophy and Islamic philosophy sort of grew up together, first in the Middle East, and then with the migration of the Abbasid Caliphate, the Cordoba Caliphate that we spoke about before in Spain, so did the growth of philosophy in these two cultures continue to flourish in Spain. The type of philosophy that was being studied among Jews and Muslims was a combination of Aristotelianism and Neoplatonism, two schools of Greek philosophy that originated with the ancient philosophers Plato and Aristotle from the 4th century before the Common Era. Their writings, however, had gone through many evolutions and developments by the time that they had arrived to the Jews and Muslims of the medieval period starting around the 10th century. Both Jewish and Islamic thinkers had developed a way of understanding the universe and of God's involvement in that universe based on these earlier writings. One important aspect of this philosophy was the role of God in the universe. Most of the real purist philosophers came to the conclusion that while God does exist, he is nothing more than what they called the prime mover, or alternatively, the prime cause. He, or it, perhaps is more appropriate, is the only unmoved mover, the only uncaused cause in a universe where everything else is moved and caused by something else. But within this definition, they concluded that this prime mover, and granted he does possess some level of sentience and awareness of what is going on in the universe, but this mover is completely unaware of the events that are going on in the world of human beings. The reason for this conclusion is based on the assumption that since the prime mover is ultimately perfect and free of any defect, it would be impossible for him to have any interaction or knowledge of what is going on in this flawed, puny, imperfect corporeal world. Indeed, even suggesting that God is in some way involved with our world was an insult to the God of the philosophers. It suggested an imperfection in a God that was completely perfect. This is the line of argument that the philosopher in the Khuzari presents to our Khazar king, King Bulan. Thus, this prime mover, this God, cannot know of man's actions. He cannot insert himself into our lives. He cannot perform miracles in a world from which he is completely disconnected. This prime mover transcends time and space completely, so it would be a diminution of his power to suggest that he can interact with any kind of time-based reality, time and space-based reality. Furthermore, the philosopher, speaking now like a good Aristotelian in this first section of the Khuzari, doesn't believe that this world could have ever been created in the first place, because the very act of creation requires a God that is inserted within time and space. That is to say, that one day a God woke up within a time-based reality and decided at one point in time to create space. And that in itself is an impossibility for the Greek philosophers. So therefore, we find the philosopher telling the Khazar king, God that you speak of could not possibly have created you. Rather, the prime cause is merely in charge of sustaining that which has existed for all of time, eternally. But this raises a very natural question. If the prime cause does not interact directly with our physical and time-bound reality, what is its function and how does it accomplish its function? The philosophical school of Neoplatonism undertook this question of how a perfect God can interact with this flawed and corporeal universe. And actually, perceptive students of the Rambam and of many other great theological thinkers all the way up to the times of the Maharal will make note of the fact that this Neoplatonic school and system of thought is very, very present in so many other authors' writings. The Neoplatonists concluded that the prime cause was responsible for emanating from itself. There was this idea of emanation, that the prime cause emanated from itself a series of causes, and those causes in turn emanated their own causes. Each succeeding emanation became less and less similar to the prime cause until the last cause, the last emanation, was sufficiently imperfect to be able to interact with our flawed and physical world and its inhabitants. Whatever interaction we do enjoy from the prime cause is really via a series of emanations, and we only interact directly with the lowest emanation. We can't interact directly with the prime cause or any emanation above the lowest emanation. In Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's time, as well as in the Rambam's, there were a series of 10 emanations. That was the accepted model of how many concentric emanations existed in the universe. These are also known as the Galgalim, or in some forms of literature, they're known as the Sefirot, when we get into more Kabbalistic literature. But there are these heavenly spheres or heavenly emanations. And each one of these spheres or emanations had a physical quality to it, in that it was responsible for containing the orbit of different celestial bodies, such as the stars, the sun, and the planets. The lowest sphere was that which was responsible for maintaining the orbit of the moon, and it was the emanation that was also responsible for maintaining the proper combination of elements within all of matter that was contained in the sublunar realm, the Earth. That is to say, if in order to make sure that the rivers were flowing properly, that the trees were growing properly, that matter was contained, that things that are comprised of compound elements were combined correctly, all this was a product of the influence of this moon sphere, this sentient emanation of the prime cause that was the lowest and was interacting most directly with our world. Now, as you can see, this philosophical system is descriptive of so many different things combined. It incorporates God, it incorporates astronomy, it incorporates astrology, and some kind of theurgic interaction between the heavenly realm and the physical and the earthly realm, I should say. It's so very foreign to our way of thinking about the cosmos today, and yet it was considered to be scientific fact for that period of time, for that period in history. Now, the one thing we haven't clarified is what the role of these emanations are vis-a-vis mankind, and why the philosopher should even spend time trying to explain this model of astronomy to the Khazar king who's really seeking purpose in life. What does this have to do with accomplishing an individual's purpose in life and providing the individual with meaning? That's going to be the subject of our next talk, and we'll take up the whole concept of how the human being interacts with this lowest emanation of the prime cause, according to the philosopher.